decade of dissident discourse. It can only be millennial. And now here is your host, Millennial Woes.
Hello and welcome back to Millennial. I'm now here for the final stream on this second night, and this is with Angelo Plume, the commentator formerly known as Pox Populi. Angelo, welcome back to Millennial. You've been on, I think this is the third or fourth time.
This would be the fourth time. Yeah, 2018 was the first year. Then there was some gap years when I kind of disappeared for a while, and then I was back on two more times. And so, yeah, this will be number four. Thank you again for having me on. It's a pleasure.
You're very welcome. I mean, people always, I think, look forward to your appearances nowadays because it tends to be a very laid-back, nice sort of stream. But on the other hand, if you're feeling quite frenzied tonight, we can do a fast-paced conversation. It's up to you. So what would you like to open with? I mean, I think we should probably open by talking about your podcast, the New Nationalism podcast, because that obviously is a new project. And we want to spread awareness of it. So how would you describe it?
Yeah, so this has been the main project, I suppose, for this year for me, along with the stuff that I do on my own personal Substack and then other, you know, social media work. And the idea behind this was to kind of go back to the basics of what we're doing this for. You know, I think you can relate to this because you've been doing it for such a long time. There's not really that much to say about nationalism and identity and immigration. Eventually, you know, you kind of say everything that needs to be said very early on. And then what's happened with internet culture, I think, it kind of obliges you to get into this cycle of hot takes and reacting to current events. And we can get kind of lost along the way. And one of my main concerns, too, is that it's becoming a bit of an entertainment sphere. Which there's nothing exactly wrong with that, because Lord knows we do need to create our own art and entertainment, especially art, but I suppose even entertainment as well, lighthearted entertainment. But what I'm really more referring to is that we kind of get sucked into just sort of scrolling and watching 10-minute YouTube videos on some current event or something that the SJWs did, or hey, did you hear about, like, you know, this OnlyFans girl and her stunt that she just did? And we kind of consume this content and then we move on to the next bit of content. And I don't even like that word. It's, whenever I hear content, I think of containers, you know, like the contents of a container. It's just kind of like Tupperware nationalism, you know? And so the idea behind this was to get back to the basics and make like a 101 course. Imagine all the questions you had, all the concerns, all the doubts you might have had, you know, 10 years ago, before you did Millennial, before you created Millennial Woes. And wouldn't it be nice for people who are just getting into this if there was something that could give them answers to all their questions in a very straightforward way and all in one place, and with some of the finest voices in this movement. So the first episode, oh, that's another thing too. You know, the word podcast, do you remember where the word podcast comes from?
It's from the iPod, isn't it?
Exactly. It was something that you downloaded on iTunes to listen to on your iPod. And that's why it was called a podcast. And it was purely audio. Now everything is a podcast. This is considered a podcast. People are just talking to microphones and even recording themselves on video in their bedrooms wearing pajamas is a podcast now. So even that term kind of has become something different. The idea that I had behind this was to make it more like an old radio broadcast, actually. Your American listeners will be familiar with NPR and the serial show that NPR has had for many years called This American Life and others. But the sort of classic radio program, radio broadcast that is episodic in nature. So with this new nationalism, it's episodic and every episode focuses on a theme. And then I bring on a guest to discuss that theme in more detail. And then I just sort of kind of play a character, like I'm a presenter of it, but I'm also kind of playing a character who's a bit ignorant of these issues. So I'm asking questions as if I'm an innocent sort of newcomer. And then there's a bit of narration. And then we also have musical interludes provided by Zurius. So this is a very cumulative work. I really wanted to do something a bit different, very professional sounding, something that you could hear on the radio, on BBC Radio, on NPR, promote our guys, promote an artist like Zurius. And so episode one is a conversation with Jared Taylor, where he and I just kind of talk about the very basics, the sort of the lies that we're supposed to believe in current year, like diversity is our strength, but also we're all the same, but we need to have more diversity. And the only way to get more diversity is to bring in other people from other races, even though race isn't real. You know, what's going on here? All these questions that we're supposed to just ignore. So he's the first guest, the first episode. And then it moves on from there, getting into other issues that we can talk about. But I think I've rambled on a bit already, so I'll give it back to you.
No, it sounds like an investigative reporter asking questions as an innocent, as a sort of naive, green-eyed person new to all of this. And so you're assuming the role of the audience that you're seeking for this, which is normies, people who are not immersed in our community, in our subculture, who don't know all the memes, who don't know all the lore, but who are concerned about this, the state of their society.
Right, because for those of us who've been doing this for a long time, you know, it's very easy to say that these things get stale. I've heard this all before. We already figured this out, 5 years ago. These are talking points from 5 years ago. Well, that's all very easy for someone who's been in this for a long time to say, but there are people who are, for every one person like that, there's 500,000 more who don't know any of this. You know, they hear nationalism and they think it's a big scary word that, that leads to the gas chambers. Or, they don't know that there are actual differences between races and that race isn't just skin deep and it does matter and it's okay to say that it does. That goes back to what I was saying earlier, that, as this thing of ours becomes so dependent on the internet and the cycle of internet culture of, reacting to current things and, if you're a leading figure in this, you're expected to have a take on everything. It just kind of becomes this cycle of putting out content. And I understand that can get stale and people seek fresh material. But we have to remember that this is kind of like a war. And if you're a soldier in the trenches, you don't get to say, hey, Sergeant, can we stop this? I'm bored. This is a bit stale. Can we get out of this trench?
Bullets are so last week.
Exactly. There was that thought in mind of, like I said, just putting this all in one place, having it presented very professionally, getting the best of the best to, really concentrate on what we're doing this for, what we stand for. Another thing too is that people will say, more and more people are waking up. Our ideas have never been more popular. Well, then that means we're getting lots of new people. And so you know, for someone like me, you know, 6 years ago, 2018, when I came onto Millennial, all those Millennial videos and your YouTube channel, all that stuff doesn't exist. It was all taken down. And there's lots of other material that's been taken down. And so, you know, the things that I read, the videos that I watched that helped me wake up and understand things and answered my questions, they don't exist anymore. If you try and find them, you get error 404 notifications. So for all these new people that were waking up and our ideas are more popular than ever, well, okay, what can we give them that can help them understand our position and answer their questions, address their concerns, and then help them along their way where they can now argue our positions themselves with confidence? So that was another important idea behind this.
And the thing is, it's actually quite an interesting challenge to present our ideas in that way for people who are completely unversed in this. Mm-hmm. So to say, to make a statement, to defend a whole body of ideas that is reviled in the mainstream, and to defend it in such a way that it will be understandable to a normie, to keep it as simple as possible, and yet also as bulletproof as possible, that's mm-hmm. actually a challenge. Because whenever we speak, we're speaking mostly to people who we know, and we expect that the audience are familiar not only with us, but with the stuff broadly that we're talking about, the stuff that we're saying. So it's not going to be completely new to them, so they don't need everything explained, and certain things can be taken for granted and all that. So these are luxuries, really. To speak to the normie is to speak without those luxuries. Things do need to be explained. Nothing can be taken for granted. So it's a different challenge, really, isn't it?
Absolutely. And, you know, I've been doing this for a while, but I've always maintained my sort of humility, I guess. And I know that I'm not actually a household name. And I'm frequently reminded that many people don't know who I am. And that's actually kind of a good thing, because I can still live a relatively normal life. But yeah, it's always good to be reminded that, you know, we kind of are a niche. Actually, no, we are a counterculture. We are a subculture and we are a counterculture. And it's good to remind ourselves of that. Particularly because we should create more culture, actually. We shouldn't just be counter. We should also be culture. But being a counterculture means that, yeah, there's a lot of people out there who don't even know we exist. And then something else that I really wanted to do with this, and it's been motivating a lot of my work and will probably continue to motivate me in the future as well, is that I wanted to make it a bit more personal. I wanted to make it a bit more intimate. Again, following the example of radio broadcasts like This American Life and things that are similar, those kinds of radio shows, you know, they would feature, like I said, a theme, every episode focused on a theme, but they would also have these really touching interviews with real people. For example, there might be an episode on, well, I guess something timely that's been in the news lately, the American healthcare system. And they would do an episode where, okay, they might have some experts, economists analyzing the economics of the healthcare system, but then they'd also interview maybe a single mom who's struggling to pay medical bills. And it was just very personal and very, very special and unique. And so one episode that I'm very proud of, I thought it came off almost exactly the way I wanted to, was episode 2, I believe, which is an interview with Laura Towler, Laura Melia. And I think your audience knows who she is. And if not, her husband, Sam Melia, was an English patriot, an English nationalist, who was sentenced to prison for creating some stickers that just had some nationalist slogans printed on them. A very obscene act of political persecution, really. And so I interviewed her, and it's just this great episode where she talks about what it's been like to grow up in a part of England where she has seen her community completely change. You know, she talks about her and her friends being kind of accosted by strange foreign men as they are walking to university campus every day. She talks about how, you know, something that I never even thought of, the high street where she was living, or where she when she was going to university, the high street was all transformed, and now it's just the clothes shops sell clothes that Indians and Pakistanis and Afghans wear, and the food shops and the restaurants are the same, and there's Indian and Pakistani and Afghan music blaring out of them onto the streets. And it's like, well, where do the native English go then if they want to buy new clothes or get a bite to eat that's English food? Well, they can't anymore because they're in the main thoroughfare of their town has been completely changed. And so I just really wanted to shine some light on the personal stories, because it's all well and good to say, you know, facts don't care about your feelings, but actually feelings don't care about facts either. And our movement has kind of failed to tell the personal stories about this and really make it really focus on those feelings, which are very, very powerful. You know, think about how we have all our graphs and charts and memes and things like that. And I can instantly pull up a chart that shows how Afghans are overrepresented, disgustingly, disproportionately overrepresented in gang rapes in Germany. Okay, but the refugees welcome side of that question that brought all these people to Germany, they have a picture of that little baby drowned on the beach in Turkey from 2015. The photo that made Angela Merkel open the doors to a million refugees. One picture, one emotionally powerful picture. Feelings matter more than facts.
And yeah, so, I mean, to be accurate, that photo didn't make her do that. That photo was used to justify her opening
right,
the doors.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that it's what worked emotionally. It pulled the heartstrings of the, mm-hmm. the normies so that they would go along with this.
Which is how so much of modern life and modern politics actually is. It's all very emotionally manipulative. So we do kind of have to engage in that. We do have to, and I don't consider it, you know, being dishonest or manipulative, because these are real stories. You know, that baby Alan, that photo was actually manipulated and sort of staged. They actually picked him up and placed him face down in the sand to have a more powerful picture. Whereas, you know, someone like Laura is not lying, what she and her husband and her family have gone through. And I just feel like we need to be telling those stories more. We need to put a personal face to this, because no one else really is telling our stories. We all know the name of George Floyd, but does anyone remember the names of all the white victims of gang rapes and murder and terror attacks and all the other things that we've been living through in Europe for so long now? Well, no, because the mainstream doesn't tell our stories. So we have to do it ourselves.
Absolutely. You know, in Britain, everyone knows the name Stephen Lawrence.
Mm-hmm.
It's been 31, I think it was 93, so it's 31 years now. Hardly anyone knows Charlene Downs, for example, which was an mm-hmm. absolutely horrific, horrendous case. I mean, it's as bad as it could. I mean, it's like something from a gore movie. It's mm-hmm. really absolutely awful. And yet her suffering is irrelevant to the mainstream media and therefore entirely unknown to the public. They simply mm-hmm. don't know what a girl went through, what was done to her. Yeah. And that's one incident. But the thing is, there have been thousands, mm-hmm. probably not as horrific as that, but still gang rape, by foreign men. I mean, thousands of English girls have gone through that.
Another story in the same episode with Laura Towler, I also invited Richard Hauck on that same episode as well. Where I sort of combined my conversations with Richard and with Laura. Richard Hauck is a lawyer and a writer who's contributed a lot to Countercurrents, for those who aren't familiar with him. And we spoke about some of the stuff that has been happening where he lives in the United States. And then we also discussed Chris Donald, the young Scottish boy who met a very gruesome.
And again, it's not a competition, obviously, but if you're going to compare his suffering with Stephen Lawrence's, his was much worse.
I mean, or George Floyd, or, you know, any of these, you know, names that have become tattooed in our global conscious. I mean, there was protests about George Floyd in Ireland, in Amsterdam.
Yeah.
You know, it just bizarre. Mental. No reason.
This gets back to something I said in 2015, early 2015. I'd had this experience where a friend of mine had been off to, I think, China for 4 months at the end of 2014, and he'd come back, and in the interim, the Rotherham report had been published and the Ferguson riots had happened. And his liberal friends, when he came back, his liberal friends told him all about the Ferguson riots, but they didn't tell him about Rotherham, which had been dominating the news headlines for about 2 weeks. And so he'd heard the word, but he didn't know what it referred to. He didn't know what had happened. What was the news story? And he asked me, I mentioned it. I said, well, what about Rotherham? And he said, yeah, what was it happened there? He didn't know.
Isn't that incredible?
It's absolutely incredible. These liberal Scottish middle-class idiots were much more concerned with riots by blacks thousands of miles away across an ocean than they were with thousands of their own co-ethnics being gang raped a few hundred miles away.
It's the power of media, it's the power of those who control the media, that they can really shape our reality.
Absolutely. In a different age, those same people would be outraged and very animated about Rotherham, and they wouldn't care at all. I mean, the media wouldn't have bothered telling them about Ferguson. That's how it should be.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean,
when your own country is under attack, your own people, not country, your own people are under attack in that way, I would say the sane reaction is to be very concerned about that indeed, very animated about that. And this gets to the whole thing about nationalism. You know, you say there's not that much to say about it, and I agree. It's more a matter of getting over that hurdle of caring about your own group, having the gall to care about your own group, which used to require no bravery at all, but now it does. Mm-hmm. And it's that simple realization that, A, your group does exist, like all these other groups that you're told to care about. Your group does exist, and it is okay to care about it, and you should care about it. Because if you don't, then nobody's going to. Well, why should anyone? Mm-hmm. So that's what there is. That's the core of nationalism, is understanding that your group exists and matters. And therefore you should fight to protect it and to better it. That's all there is to it, really, isn't it? It's harder than it sounds. You know, it's a simple thing, but
it's surprisingly harder than it sounds. Because of this, of so much of, you know, the propaganda, and the world has changed, and, you know, for Europeans, the world wars, really, I mean, every now and again, I just let it sink in how destructive it must have been to go through two world wars in one century, and all the destruction and death. And it's been very easy to craft these narratives after the war that, you know, it was all the fault of nationalism. It was all the fault of European bloodlust and racism. And so therefore we must always be punishing ourselves and beware of our own selves. We have these demons inside us that could, you know, go crazy at any moment. Even if you fought on the side of the Allies, you're still somehow complicit in the sins of the Germans and the Italians.
Because you're white like them.
You know, right, exactly.
We fought them because they were different from us, but in the modern context, they're the same as us. So
it's done a number on everyone, and so really it is difficult to overcome the conditioning and the propaganda. And that's why I just think the personal stories are so much more effective, actually, because I have years of using the cold, hard facts and logic approach, and I don't think it's actually been that effective, to be honest. But, you know, there's in that interview in the episode with Laura Towler, like there's a moment where you can hear her young children, her baby kind of crying in the background for a brief moment. And I just thought, like, that was an accident, I guess, you know, in a way. But I thought it was actually perfect because it just humanized her so much more. Like, this is a young mother whose husband is in jail. The father of her children is in jail. And she's been debanked and deplatformed and censored all because she's standing up for her people and she's trying to prevent other young girls from suffering the fate of those girls in Rotherham. And for that, she's being persecuted. It's like, I can tell you that. I can write an essay about it. I can show you a graph chart about these things, but it doesn't quite hit as hard as when you hear her tell her story herself and her baby cries in the background. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. It's like the thing that the famous quote from Stalin, I don't know if it's apocryphal or not, but the death of one man is a tragedy. The death of a million is a statistic.
Mm-hmm.
If you humanize it, you understand, or you have some chance of understanding the significance of the million if you concentrate on the one, because it's the same thing multiplied many, many, many times. And that same tragedy, the same heartache. You know, if we talk about one victim of gang rape, then you've got to multiply her suffering across the thousands. If you just talk about the thousands, it's very abstract. It's a statistic. It's a fact. Mm-hmm. But it's not human, and so a lot of people will put up a barrier to that, and just say, "Well, presumably the police are dealing with it. It's not my problem. There's no reason why I should care about this. There's no reason why I should racistly get worked up about it." But if you concentrate on one victim, it's much harder for them to do that because the suffering is there, and as you say, the humanity is there. And yeah, I mean, what Laura and her husband have been put through is just outrageous, and people should be outraged by it. I think it's, again, when you compare the how he has been treated for what he's done with how other people of other races and other ethnic persuasions, how they've been treated for what they've done. I mean, it's staggering, really. Well, we're still waiting, I'm pretty sure, for the three Muslims attacked police at the Manchester airport. I think it's 3 months ago now, 4 months ago. They've still not, as far as I know, nothing has happened to them yet. They broke a policewoman's nose and nothing has happened yet. As far as I know. I mean, this is astonishing.
No, it's the UK justice system seems to just be an absolute farce at this point where there's paedophiles who are being let loose or given suspended sentences, people who have child pornography all over their hard drives, suspended sentence. They emptied the prisons so that they could stuff them with, you know, people who stood nearby a so-called riot over the summer over there in England. It's really heartbreaking and infuriating to see what's happening to England and, you know, the United Kingdom in general. And even next door over in Ireland, it's the same story. Ireland is now being hit with this too, very quickly, very rapidly. And again, I think that there's so many stories out there that need to be told, and it needs to be humanized. It needs to be personalized. Otherwise, I do feel that people, the broader public, well, A, they don't even hear about these stories. And then to the extent that they do, it's just presented as sort of, you know, like I said, cold facts, charts, statistics. But if you can really put a name and a face to these injustices, then I think it's much more powerful. And it's not only that. I mean, there's other episodes too where, like I said, this is a sort of a 101 course for people who are discovering our ideas. So then there's episodes with White Papers, Policy Institute, Cyan, who you had on opening night, a very good episode with her, where we talk about statistics and numbers and how immigration has changed and how it's increased. And we focus on the United States and we focus on Sweden and Ireland. And it's another great episode because it's full of facts. So that we do focus on facts as well. Just every episode has a theme. So there's an episode, if you have a sort of autistic friend that does care about facts and you could impress upon them the factual side of this era that we're living in and the consequences of these immigration delusions, these luxury policies, then you could send that friend the episode with White Papers, because it is all about statistics and facts and numbers and with sources and all that. But if you want to send someone who's maybe more impressed by the emotional side of this, personal stories, we've done that too. And then the latest episode was with Keith Woods, who I think also sensed that we needed to go back to our roots, because he just put out that book about nationalism, and the history of nationalism, where it comes from, how far back are its origins, what it means, what it stands for. And so I interviewed him for the latest episode. And that was also serving another reason why I created this, which was to promote our guys, promote the people in this movement who are doing good work. I think it's great whenever we make stuff, real books, poetry collections. And I would love to promote more, especially the artists, people who are making music, people who are making, like I said earlier, books or poetry, or I know there's some people who make like comic, once a month comic book issues or things like that, the Bizarre Archives, stuff like that. I think all that is great. We're, you know, creating that ecosystem of culture and entertainment and even economics that's all sort of self-sustained within our movement is very good and very worthwhile. And so I wanted to do my bit to promote the people who are making those efforts.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. This is something that I've always tried to cultivate and coax, the emergence of an ecosystem, as you say, where it becomes self-sustaining. That's a huge goal. I think it would be fantastic if we could do that, if we could end up with a sort of virtual community of like a market square of people exchanging goods. That'd be wonderful. We'll maybe get there. So are you envisioning the New Nationalism podcast to be a long running thing, or do you think it has a finite life?
I think it's a finite life, honestly. I think it would probably be best to maybe sort of like the British Office, you know, two seasons, go out with a bang, you know, have everything sort of said and done within two seasons. Maybe even one, just this one season, and then I'll do something different. I would like, you know, maybe sort of following the similar model, but instead of interviews kind of that are within our movement, kind of internally within our movement, I think it would be great if I could actually go and speak to some of these survivors, you know, some of the victims of these delusional policies, these abusive policies, people who are not a part of this. You know, Laura is a part of this movement. Sam is a part of this movement. Keith Woods is a part of this movement. But, you know, has anyone from the BBC or De Velde or La Repubblica or, you know, any of the mainstream media outlets, have they ever gone to speak with the families of girls who were abused and raped or possibly even killed, you know, the Rotherham? And have they done it as a sympathetic agent, not someone who's looking for an angle or trying to disparage them. You know, because I've seen some mainstream media reports on these issues, and they will try to obfuscate, or they might even have a slight dig at, because these are working class communities, so they might even have little digs. There's that famous example where Konstantin Kyssin is speaking with a survivor of
that is just so bad.
Yeah, you know which one I'm talking about. Where, yeah,
but other people might
not. So for those who don't, Konstantin Kyssin, he's the host of that Trigonometry podcast. He is, I believe, an ethnically Russian Jew. And he's basically a centrist. He's a liberal driving the speed limit. And he's clearly opposed to Europeans having any sort of in-group preference or solidarity amongst themselves and protecting their communities like everyone else does with their communities, particularly Konstantin's very own. And there's this famous, within our circles, a very famous clip of him interviewing a grooming gang survivor. And she sort of implies that she wished that her community, fellow English people, had protected her or stood up for her, or that the ruling class, the political system, had protected her and the other victims. And Konstantin Kyssin interjects and tells her, oh, be careful, though. You don't want too much of that, because whenever white people see themselves as a collective and they have solidarity, well, that could lead to, you know, the Nazis, basically. It's just such a horrible, disgusting thing to say.
It really is. And the thing is, it's completely inappropriate for him to say, and offensive for him to say that to her, particularly.
Right.
The victim of rape, who would undoubtedly have been safe from that had there been more collectivism, more collective identity in the English. But also, it's I think he said it for the benefit of his audience, because he didn't want it. This is the gatekeeping thing, where the audience are currently in danger of being seduced by this idea, so I better ward them off by warding her off. But it's not really about her. It's just, it's to make sure they don't get any ideas.
Mm-hmm. No, and he hasn't stopped. I mean, he's one of the, well, he's recently abandoned it. He's given up on it because it was such a dud to begin with. But he was one of the voices trying to popularize the woke right term.
Yeah, because it's exactly the same thing. It's exactly the same crusade there. He might as well have said to that girl, well, you don't want to become woke right.
Mm.
It's exactly the same thing he's saying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
White people must not identify as a group, whether they're the
or feel any sense of victimization, feel any sense of persecution, because that's
Even when you're being gang raped, even when your community is being targeted for gang rape by a foreign mm-hmm. group, you must not identify with the group. I mean, it's absolutely unbelievable.
Yeah.
You say he gave up on it. As far as I know, what I saw, he's got me blocked on Twitter, but I saw this.
Me too.
Yeah, I think he's probably blocked everyone. What I saw was he was saying he'll give up on it if someone can come up with a better term for this. So he didn't. I don't think he gave up on it as such. He just laid down the gauntlet for come up with some other euphemism for nationalism, for white nationalism.
Yeah,
that's because ultimately that's what all of this is about. It's he is a grifter and a gatekeeper and a shill, trying like James Lindsay
mm-hmm.
to ward people off, to keep them on the plantation.
Yep.
Of race-blind civic nationalism, which is a concern now. It was easier to do that in the 90s. Much more of a challenge nowadays because of the alt-right in the 2010s, because of things like the Rotherham Report, because of just the sheer numbers of foreigners in our countries now. So for all these reasons, it's much more of a challenge to get people to not care about race because there are so many reasons why they should care about race at this point. I mean, when you're talking about mass gang rape, I think that's a pretty fucking good reason to care about your group at that point.
Well, something that James Lindsay and Constantine Kissin and many others, even there's a bit of this sometimes within our own circles. There's this thing where they don't want to promote victim narratives or, the victimhood Olympics. We don't want to participate in that. And it's when it appears in our circles, it's usually someone saying it's beneath white people to play the victim. We don't do that.
This is just such an unnecessary diversion.
Yes.
You know, I agree. From personal experience, self-pity doesn't really get you anywhere. It's not helpful. It's debilitating.
Mm-hmm.
Sure, that's true. But at the same time, it's also true that we really are victims.
Exactly.
So it's not a matter of, well, we should all feel sorry for ourselves and become weak and debilitated. It's we should defend ourselves.
Exactly.
We should do exactly. something about this. We should.
And if you look,
if the alternative is, well, we're just going to keep letting Pakistanis rape our girls. No, but that's insane. That's insane. Yeah. So recognizing that you are being victimized is not the same thing as marinating in victimhood. That's simply, yeah. I mean, that is just, imagine saying to someone, well, okay, so you've been targeted, you've been beaten up, beaten to a pulp, they've done all sorts of things to you, but you're not a victim. I mean, mm-hmm. Don't see yourself as a victim. I mean, mm-hmm. that is ridiculous. No one would ever say that. They can only make this argument because of the separation between the two things. We actually are being victimized. In fact, just mass immigration alone mm-hmm. is victimizing.
I've always said that it would be bad enough. It would already be a crime against our peoples if it was just mass immigration and demographic replacement, and we're being reduced to minorities in our own cities. There's even an EU-funded research project entitled Becoming a Minority, which documents several European cities all over the continent, wherein the native Europeans are now the minority, as the title suggests. This is real, it's happening, and it's wrong, and it would have been wrong no matter what. But then you add on top of it that all these people who are coming in to do the replacement are also stabby, rapey, evil people who keep committing disproportionate amounts of violent crime against us.
Yeah, I shouldn't say all of them, but just for the sake of the hate.
Not all of them.
But the point is...
A shocking amount.
There is. I mean, it's clear from the statistics. It's obvious. And it's obvious just from common sense that if you large numbers of people come unselected from backward cultures, of course they're going to behave in a backward way mm-hmm. once they're in Europe, and hey presto, they do.
Exactly. And another thing I often ask is, because it happens so often, so I have to ask often, is, you know, what sort of refugee shows his gratitude to the people who gave him refuge by raping and murdering them? It's just, you know, we keep living in this world of lies that don't withstand the slightest investigation or inquiry, but we all just keep going along with it over and over and over. And I just try to find effective ways to dismantle this. And, you know, I suppose that if you believe in elite theory, waking up the masses and getting more people on our side doesn't even really matter. And I can understand people who take that position, but it's not unhelpful to wake up more people and get more people on our side. And, you know, like going back to that thing of, you know, oh, don't be a victim, don't be victimized. Well, if you look at the history of nationalist movements, particularly from the 18th century on, there is a moment where there is more or less mass recognition, mass to the extent that it could be in a time before mass communications, but there's a sort of moment of mass recognition. Usually the catalyst is a work of art. There's a painting, The Massacre at Chelios, I believe it's called, that depicts Ottoman Turks massacring Greeks, that helped inspire the Greek nationalist revolt against the Turks. If you look at Irish nationalism and how the poetry of Yeats and the revival of Irish folk tunes and converting them into rebel songs inspired people who weren't actually on the side of the Irish rebels at various stages in that long struggle for independence. There were times where the majority of the Irish people didn't want to kick up a fuss. They didn't. So, for example, in 1916, the majority of the Dubliners didn't support the Irishmen who carried out the Easter Rising. But it wasn't until after they were executed and they became martyrs and their story was told through the artistic expression of song and fable that the rest of the Irish population rallied behind them and saw them as heroes. And so you have to have a moment where it's not wallowing in pity or playing the victimhood Olympics, it's acknowledging what's going on and inspiring people to take action to put an end to it and make things right. And I think we need to do that. It's all well and good to have hot takes on the current thing and do deep dives into esoteric philosophy and things like that, especially if you've been doing this a long time and you know you've said everything that you wanted to say. But we have to remember what we're doing this for at the end of the day. And I think that is it. We want there to be a moment where we shake off the guilt, we shake off the mythology of, you know, World War II, Nuremberg narratives, and we just say, no, enough is enough. You can't do this to us. And there is an us. We are an us. And it's okay to acknowledge that.
It's sane to acknowledge that, and it's truthful to acknowledge that, and it's dishonest to deny it. And again, common sense would come to the rescue here if only more people had more of it, I guess. But that is the challenge. Is your common sense is telling you something, but the whole, you know, the media is telling you the opposite. And mm-hmm. and even Constantine Kissin is telling you the opposite, mm-hmm. Despicably.
If they're even bothering to tell our stories at all, that's what really bothers me, is how much gets ignored.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, people don't know the name Charlene Downs or Chris Donnell or Ebba mm-hmm. Åkerlund from Stockholm. Mm-hmm. No, mm-hmm. nobody knows this.
Yeah.
And as for, because it's an interesting question you asked about the BBC interviewing rape victims of Rotherham and so on. And again, it's not just Rotherham. And very mm-hmm. important to yes. emphasize that. Yes. Rotherham is the sort of fulcrum. It's the touchstone. There's a word that I'm, but that's because it was the biggest and it's like the first. Mm-hmm. After Rochdale, there was Rochdale, then there was Rotherham, but there have been many others since then. So it's
not just England.
Oh,
there's comparative phenomena, I guess, for lack of a better term. In Italy, for example, there's like a Nigerian mafia that has gone around raping and murdering young Italian girls. It's everywhere. And why are these people here? What are they doing here? We don't need them. And they're doing bad things to us. And so they need to go. They need to go. They need to be punished. And we need to also punish the people who brought this upon us, those who sit in Brussels, in London, in Rome, in Washington, D.C. And yes, I sympathize with elite theorists. I think they're more or less correct, but you need to have a marriage of the two. You need to get elites on your side and you need to have elites in your ranks, rising in your ranks that can compete with rival elites. But you also need to have a populist side as well and people who will be willing to follow the elites or willing to have solidarity within their own communities, whether it's just a neighborhood or something bigger, you know, your province, your region, and then ultimately your nation. We do need to have a bit of both in order to be effective here.
Yeah, I agree. At any rate, I don't think it can hurt to have both. I mean, why not? Yeah. It's like the meme, you know, why not both? But yeah, about the BBC interviewing victims, I'm sure it's happened, and I'm sure that I've seen it happen on TV, but I haven't had a TV for a long time now, so I haven't seen it. But my suspicion is they would do it, but they would use it in such a way to further their own cause, their own goals. So they would say, okay, you were gang raped, but it wasn't just brown men, was it? There were white men involved as well. So this isn't a racial thing. that sort of thing. They'd find a victim who would say, yeah, it was white men as well. That is the sort of trick that they would pull.
If I remember correctly, I think The Guardian or The Telegraph took that tack where they minimized the racial and religious aspect to the Pakistani Muslim rape gangs by, you know, kind of directing the spotlight more onto the fact that there's also white English. Yeah. There's no other kind of English. There's also English. Like, lo and behold, there's English rapists in England. Yes. Okay. We know.
Exactly. Exactly. And what they'll say is most pedophiles are English or they're white. Mm-hmm. What they ignore there is it's not about absolute numbers, it's the per capita, it's like how exactly. much more likely is especially given their respective percentages of the population, but also the other thing they're ignoring is we know for a fact that massive numbers of Pakistanis have done this and not been convicted, so then they're not part of the statistics. So when they say most grooming gangs are white, which I simply, I mean, even common sense would tell you, does that even sound likely? Does that even sound plausible? Given the grubbiness of this behavior and the ethnic, I mean, are white men likely in such huge numbers to do this to their own girls as to rival the Pakistanis doing it in number? Of course.
Well, that's an important detail too. Yes. There are English pedophiles in England. What a surprise. But are they targeting Pakistani girls? Is there a gang? Is there an organized network of English men targeting brown Pakistani girls?
And this is something that
I just realized does not exist.
Yeah, this is something that I only realized this year. What lefties will say to you is, you only care about this when it's brown men doing it. You don't care. You don't actually care about the girls. You just want to weaponize their victimization to further your political causes. So you only care when it's brown men. Or they'll say, so it's worse when it's brown men, is it? But here's the thing. This is what I just realized this year. The left always understand that race, that it is worse when it's interracial. If it's white people doing something to colored people. Because then they'll say, well, that adds the hate element. That it's not just that you didn't just punch him. You punched him because he was brown. Therefore, you're a racist on top of a violent hooligan or whatever. You're also a racist. So whenever it's the other way around, they instantly recognize that it does matter more. It is worse if it's interracial.
Another example would be police shootings in the United States. Exactly. There's plenty of examples of black cops shooting a black criminal who's not cooperating or who looks like he's going to take out a weapon. There's examples of that. No one on the liberal side of things, none of the race grievance grifters, the NAACP, all of them, they don't care about that. But if a white police officer, neutralizes a black criminal, then that's, we all know what happens when yeah. that's the case.
Yeah.
Yeah. Once again, liberals don't abide by their own standards.
Of course. And this is human nature, to care about your group being violated by another group. So if a crime happens that across the racial lines, that does add a racial dimension to it. And so, yeah, I am more, I mean, I don't like Jimmy Savile. I don't like the Catholic priests raping boys or whatever. But I am more outraged by foreigners doing it to our group, because that does add a racial element. Because there's always this question, well, what is the dynamic between their group and ours then, if they're prepared to do this? I mean, we know what the dynamic is between us and Catholic priests or whatever, because they're the same group as us. But with Pakistanis or whatever, it gives the sense that there is a latent war going on here between their group. Like their group is waging war on our group. Now, I'm not saying that's the truth. I'm just saying that is the underlying dynamic that is illuminated by this particular crime. And it's the same thing that BLM perceive when they complain about white cops shooting black criminals or black suspects. What they're aware of, what they're fearing, what they're worrying about is, well, the white system is at war with us.
Exactly.
So we need to be very woke. We need to be very aware of this.
Well, you've used the operative word. That's where it comes from. Woke.
Yeah, I know.
Like podcast used to mean something. Woke was a liberal, but it came from like black slang.
I know. But I don't want to get waylaid into that.
But it's just that the way I thought it's appropriate that word came out because it's like we need to be awake. We need to be woke. Yes. Where they put it to the things that are happening to us. Well,
absolutely, because this
we
is
do
about
too. But then you get James Lindsay coming around saying, "No, don't pay attention. That makes you just like them." It's like, well, girls are being raped. What are you talking about?
But the point is that this is about group dynamics, and someone like James Lindsay will try to get us to believe that there are no group dynamics, or group dynamics only matter if you make them matter. Well, again, this comes back to you might not care about group dynamics, but group dynamics care about you. Mm-hmm. Your skin color is your uniform, whether you like it or not. And
we're all individuals, but what do you call a group of individuals? Well, we start having neighborhoods, communities, provinces, regions, nations. Yes, we're all individuals, but we form parts of various collectives, and it's possible that collectives can be antagonistic towards one another. And one of the reasons too that you kind of touched on it there was when it's a foreign people doing that, it does smack of the behavior of invaders. That we kind of, I feel like that's maybe it's like a latent reaction that we kind of instinctively remember this through blood memory or just any knowledge of history that, foreign peoples coming into your country and committing acts of violence and abusing you and mistreating you and then even ruling over you. And as they've now done, as they've infiltrated positions of government or taking over entire swathes of your country, that smacks of invasion. And that reminds one of the behavior of an invading army, soldiers that, invade a country and start doing horrible things to the people who they've invaded. We moderns like to pretend that this stuff doesn't exist anymore. We're beyond history. We're all Fukuyamas we're so advanced that none of this matters anymore. But it does. It does. And it still plays out in real life.
Well, again, the left would understand this effortlessly if it were the other way around. I mean, one thing that occurred to me was, let's say there's a girl in, let's say, Rotherham, and she's being gang raped, she's being targeted, groomed. It's very possible that she grew up in Rotherham, her parents grew up there, her grandparents grew up there, lived there, her great-grandparents lived there. It's very possible that when a foreigner rapes her, he's raping her in the town, in the area that her great-grandparents knew. And no one ever talks about this because it's sort of irrelevant to the crime itself. I understand that, but it does add... When you think of it in those terms, it really brings it home. I mean, how dreadful a thing this is. Like, can you imagine saying to her great-grandparents, one day that in this town, on the streets that you know, in a house that you have seen, that you've walked past, a brown man will be raping your great-granddaughter? I mean, imagine saying that to them.
Mm-hmm.
What they would think of that, how they would...
I think you can relate to this because you've been doing this a long time too. But, and maybe for those in the audience, because there is a divide, there's sort of like a hierarchy in this thing of ours where there's people who put their face out there or their voice out there and they make content. And then there's, the followership, as I call it, the people who they have their favorite, public figure who they like and support, and they never miss a video or they always read his stuff, but they don't make stuff themselves, and that's fine. They donate, they read, they share. That's the role that they play. Well, for those of us who make stuff, write things, watch things, make videos and all that. Like we expose ourselves to a lot of grim stuff and it can get very demoralizing. And I'm sure the fellowship does this as well. You know, they know these things too. But when you make stuff, like there are times where I don't want to write about, this is what going back to what I was saying at the top of the hour, you know, I would like to tell our stories. I would like to see more art. I would like to see, you know, an ecosystem of art and economy and supporting our artists and things like that. And also just making a basics 101 course for new people in this thing. Because like, I don't want to write about all of the atrocities anymore. I don't want to, all of the abuses and the injustices and the insults and reacting to it and look, you know, they've desecrated committed another act of desecration of, you know, a Tolkien adaptation, or like you did the thing with Doctor Who and all these things. It hurts. It's, if you've been doing it for a long time, it really sucks. But, like you, that you just mentioned that example there of, can you imagine, you know, these towns, these cities, these cobblestone streets, these, you know, farmers markets, and just imagine, you know, within two generations, that alley right down there, well, that's where your granddaughter is going to be raped by a Pakistani for some reason. But I have actually asked myself that or put myself in that situation, and I've been there. You know, you'll see a video, an old film footage of even now, like 19th century Paris, you know, because now they're restoring these old discovered film reels and they're colorizing it. And some people are even putting music over it. And it's very touching. And you just think, like, less than 100 years later, or, you know, about 100 years later, that same city of Paris that is, you know, so quaint and truly beautiful. There was a reason why it used to be called the City of Light, and it was such a magnet. It really was a beautiful city back in the day. And to just think that 100 years later, you know, there's going to be people inside a theater called Bataclan getting massacred by Muslim terrorists. It hurts. And that's what I'm saying, is that we need to tell these stories and we need to react accordingly to the feelings that they inspire in us.
Yeah, I agree. I'm not really sure what to say to that. I mean, you can get quite worked up about it. Like I was just getting quite worked up about that, because it does just, when you link it to the past, like tangible people, someone's great grandfather, some working class guy in Rotherham, when you link it to the past in that way, the outrage of what's happening now in the present is magnified, because precisely for the reasons that the left would understand. Mm-hmm. This is a people mm-hmm. with a history, and you're violating them. Well, yeah, but this is ours. This is our people. This is our history. We are being violated. You know, I want to get the leftists to understand it. Stand up for yourself, for your own group. You know, it is incredibly exasperating. But you know, I shouldn't be exasperated by it. That's why I should be used to it. But God Almighty, when I start thinking about it, it really does. It still gets to me now. But what you were saying there, you know, I don't really focus on this stuff for this reason, because it mm-hmm. is so depressing. I've thought it through before till I'm blue in the face, and I've talked about it an awful lot. So for those of us who are more seasoned in all of this, it can be rather tiresome to hear. Like, there's the cliche of the person who ODs on the red pill. They've got the zeal of the convert. They're just into it, and they're gorging on doom porn or outrage porn. And it's tedious for people like us to listen to such a person, because we know all this. We've heard all of this. But for them, it's a necessary rite of passage, because it's them grasping the full enormity of what's been done to us and the situation that we're in. And sometimes I feel it's bad, actually. I feel guilty for red-pilling someone, because, you're, in a way, you're not doing them a favor. It's almost cruel because you're opening their eyes to such massive injustice and corruption.
It is a bit cruel. The red pill is obviously taken from the Matrix, and they choose to take the red pill to see things the way they are. And then what's different is that in the film, there's an organized group of people that take the newbies in, and there's an organization, and there's a cause, and they're inspired, and they offer an alternative. One thing, I think it's been a common thread in this conversation tonight, is, you know, what are we offering? What are we standing for? What is it? Yes, it may be a bit tiresome for those of us who are seasoned, but we have to keep plugging away. And if you red pill someone, if you offer them that red pill, they see all of the horrors and the mess that we're in, and that there's so many responsible people, and they don't seem to ever suffer any consequences. And what can we do? Well, do we have an answer to that final question? What can we do? What are we offering? You know, that was a question that I asked Keith Woods in the episode we recorded of that New Nationalism, just to sort of, I guess, take it back to that thing. You know, and I asked it to every guest, I think I've asked, because I really want to make sure that we put this out there. We know what George Soros stands for. We know what global capital stands for. We know the kind of world they want and what they're forging. More or less. And then to the extent that there are complicit politicians and all that sort of thing, what are we offering as an alternative? What do we stand for? What's our vision? It can't just be, well, you know, please stop demographically replacing us with mass immigration. Okay, that's part of it. But we can't just be saying, oh, we want to go back to, you know, like in America, they always cite the 1950s as their heyday. Let's just go back to the way things were in the 1950s. Or now it's even, let's just go back to the 1990s even. I don't think that's quite good enough. We have to be offering something better, deeper, longer lasting. And I think that is what nationalism stands for, is that we do want to put an end to this. We want to put an end to the suffering, the abuses, the injustices. But then we also have something to offer that you can live by and be inspired by and go forward with. I think that's an important element.
I think what nationalism offers is the prize, but also the responsibility of realizing that we're not going back to anything. It's about the future. And as much as we take solace and comfort in the past and nostalgia, the ultimate consequence of nationalism is that your group has a future, that your group will exist in the future. But as I say, it's a responsibility, because it will only have a future if we act now, if we do things now. So I think that is what nationalism offers. It's the truth that you have a job to do to keep this going. It's not just about being harking back to the past, trying to recreate the past, though I personally would love to do that. We can't do that. I mean, the 90s isn't coming back. The 50s isn't coming back. The 1850s isn't coming back.
There are examples of it. Future. You know, Hungary, actually, Budapest is kind of like a city that's living by the "we are so back" meme, because they are restoring a lot of classical buildings and they're building new buildings in the classical style so that the new buildings actually fit aesthetically alongside the older buildings. Statues and monuments that the communists had taken down, they are either recreating or restoring them. I get what you're saying. You know, you can't be stuck in the past.
Would just say that's not being stuck in the past. That's the equivalent of pest control or monstrosity control. There's no reason why we should be surrounded by ugliness now and in the future.
The Renaissance movement was a movement that looked to the past, but then went forward. So I agree with you. I sympathize with you. I feel the same, that actually, yes, the past is quite nice. There were things that were better in the past and we should look to the past, but not in a way of, you know, oh, Why can't it be the 1950s? I wish it was. Well, no, let's be inspired by the things that worked in the past. Let's be inspired by things that look beautiful from those times, and then go forward though, with a vision for the future.
Yeah, absolutely. And it really is about finding that vision, and also being inspired by the simple fact that at various points in the past, our people were simply more confident, more mm-hmm. self-aware than they are now. I mean, they understood that they did exist. that and they had a love of it. They had a passion for it. They were inspired by it. That, I think, is the core of what's been lost. It's this the rank nihilistic individualism that ends up with a young person saying, well, why should I care about my nation, my people, my ethnic group? I've got plans. This is what I said in my NPI speech in 2016. The big problem is that people don't identify that. The big problem is that too many people already agree with Konstantin Kissin. Mm. They already live by his poisonous advice.
Yeah.
People should, we should be inspired by our ancestors insofar as we should care about our people and our countries and our culture, and really be inspired by it. Because everyone else is inspired by there. I mean, you could say, well, that sounds all a bit abstract. Well, just look what everyone else does. This does work for everyone else. So there's no reason it wouldn't work for us.
Well, certainly, I've asked myself, I've wondered this, because also, you know, I'm sort of a nationalist without a nation. People who know my story know that I've moved around a lot, and I'm an actual genuine refugee in the sense that I had to leave my country of birth because it was becoming...
Refugees welcome here.
Yeah, it was becoming an unlivable hellscape. And people know that I went back to my roots. I went back to Europe and very quickly found that it wasn't much of a place of refuge because the same things are going on here, which is really annoying when you hear people say to like some white American, why don't you go back to Europe? If you don't like diversity, if you don't like living next to, you know, people of color, just go back to Europe. Have you been here lately? But anyway, that's neither here nor there. What comes to mind often is, I can't even imagine, because I've never actually experienced it. I can only imagine, I guess, rather, what it must feel like to live in a country where people are united and feel like they have a positive vision for the future and everyone's kind of working towards it and they've got their eyes to heaven, their chest is puffed out and they feel good about themselves. There's no guilt, there's no subversion, there's no one telling them that they're privileged. They think, yeah, we are privileged, we're the best people in the world, of course we have privilege. It's a privilege to be English, it's a privilege to be Italian, it's a privilege to be Spanish, whatever, you know. And I just don't know what that's like because I've never, I mean, even in America, there's a bit of it, but it's more like civic nationalism. But also still in America, you have the guilt of slavery and all this other stuff. So there's always this poison in the well that prevents the population, the white population in particular, from feeling good about themselves and from feeling like they have a cause and a purpose and a vision that they can all get behind. And I know it exists because I've spoken to people who are older than I am, who lived in times where they did have this. What seems to have happened is that, like I said earlier, you know, the two world wars really screwed us up. And it opened the door for lots of subversion and school marmy sort of hectoring and guilt and all this other stuff. So that for the generations since the Second World War, we've just been wallowing in this, like you said, nihilism, atomization, ugliness. And clearly that's not good for the soul of a nation. And nations do have souls because people, I guess, have souls. And a nation is a collective of people.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, I did grow up in a homogenous place. So I have had that experience. I do know what it was like, and it was great. Certainly, it was so good that, I mean, I didn't enjoy it at the time. I didn't value it at the time. But as soon as I moved to London, I was famously, everyone knows my red pill story. the contrast was enough to get me quite depressed and troubled and stressed. So it's like one of those things where you only realize what you've got when you lose it. So I did have that. What I didn't have was a country, as you described, where people were proud of it and inspired by it and committed to it and so forth. That was gone.
There was a moment, and I would like to hear your thoughts on this, because I assume you were there at the time. Right around the time when London hosted the Olympics, so that would be 2012, there was I perceived this as an outsider, not being in Britain at that time. But I did perceive that there was this little fillip of revitalized British patriotism. Obviously, it wouldn't be the patriotism that we might approve of. It was a bit still very civic patriotism. But it coincided with the return of Doctor Who, the Sherlock series with Benedict Cumberbatch had a bit of this going. Like, British television was top dog again. The Olympics were in London, and Britain did very well. They won lots of gold medals. And I perceived as an outsider that there was this brief moment where there was this wave of feel good, that it was permissible once more to feel proud to be British and fly the Union Jack. What did you notice this at that time?
I've got to say, no, I didn't. I think but I can understand what you're saying. From an outsider perspective, it would seem that, oh, Britain's doing quite well just now. I can understand that, and I don't even think that's false. But in terms of pride, the Olympic ceremony was very left-wing. Mm-hmm. Danny Boyle did it, if I recall mm-hmm. correctly, and it had the big thing about the NHS nurses and all that, mm-hmm. Our NHS. But that is a form of pride. I mean, they were authorizing people to feel pride in their country. So to that extent, yes, you're right. But what I would say is where I felt this far more genuinely was not the Olympics, not 2012, but when the Queen died.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. When Queen Elizabeth II, mm-hmm. obviously. I'm trying to remember, I think it was 2 years ago now. Mm-hmm. And then the coronation of Charles, I think it was 6 months later. But especially when the Queen died, because that really was ethnic. And mm-hmm. and by choice. You know, there was no reason mm-hmm. why brown people, black people couldn't be there in the crowds, but they weren't.
Mm-hmm.
So it's sort of like mm-hmm. implicit nationalism, or just natural, organic nationalism.
I was really touched by that as well. I made a choice to refrain from any criticism of Elizabeth or the royal family. It was not the right time. Yeah. And I am an unironic monarchist. I like monarchy. I think it's great. And something similar happened in Spain recently, where there was these massive, terrible floods in Valencia.
Let me just...
Oh, sorry. Go ahead. Yeah.
Because... And it did annoy me that some people poo-pooed it and said, well, what did she do for our country and all that? All of mm-hmm. that's legitimate. It's all true. I agree with you. Mm-hmm. And I'm a monarchist, and I think that it shouldn't just be ornamental, symbolic. Mm-hmm. I agree with all that. She should have done more. She could have done more. Sure. But that's irrelevant to what I'm saying, which is there was a sense of collective identity and solidarity, and it was meaningful. It wasn't lowbrow either. It wasn't sort of football hooliganism or whatever. It was a genuine sensitivity about nationhood and yeah. And collectivism and identity, and so that was definitely a moment where you felt that Britain was real again, and you know, Britain is a corporate identity. It doesn't matter. England is real again. Scotland is real again. Mm-hmm. You had that sense then. So definitely it is there. It's absolutely there. I mean, it's a very natural thing. You can suppress it, but it could, and this is what the left understand, that it could resurge at any moment. And this is why they're always so shit scared about it. So sorry, if you want to tell your story about Spain.
Well, yeah, something else, something similar was displayed in Spain not too long ago. There was these terrible floods in Valencia. And a few days after the carnage, you know, the city's covered in mud and people are dead, hundreds. The final tally, I'm sure, is actually thousands. It was very, very bad. And the left-wing socialist government, headed by this very narcissistic psychopath named Pedro Sanchez, it's all been very inept, his reaction. Nobody was coming to help. The first people to arrive, the first bombardiers, firemen who arrived in Valencia to help actually came from France, because the Spanish order was to stand down. Something similar happened in the United States after that hurricane, actually. It was very eerie how so many Western governments just seem to hate their own people so much these days. What's going on there? But anyway, a few days later, finally, the Prime Minister, Pedro Sanchez, and the King, Felipe, and his wife, the Queen. So the political head of state and the figurehead, ornamental head of state, both go to Valencia. And the reaction from the people said so much, and it's why I'm a monarchist, and it's why these symbols matter, it's why symbolism matters. It's why the king and the queen are the father and mother of the people. It's where we get the word patria from, pater, right? Patriotism. The dramatic term is heimat, but the Latin term is patria. When you feel connected to your land, to your country, to your home. And the king, the father, who all the same criticisms could be made about him that were made about, the House of Windsor and Elizabeth. It's all the same. They're all globalist stooges. They could have done more. They don't do enough. But what happened was the people turned on the prime minister, the political careerist, the scummy politician who's just a power-hungry, greedy man in a suit. They turned on him. They threw mud and rocks at him. He had to tuck his tail between his legs and escape in his, private SUV with bulletproof windows, and he was escorted away, carried away by his security team. But the king stood firm, and he took some boos and some whistles, and he absorbed the anger of and sadness, pain of the people. And then there was this moment where they realized, actually it's not the king's fault. And the king realized, you're like my children. I understand you. And then he was just overwhelmed by this embrace. The people embraced him and he embraced them back, and the queen as well. And they're crying together. And it was just so beautiful to see that. And you don't get that with these careerist politicians who don't care, but you do get these moments where the king, the father, or the queen, the mother, they do represent that connectivity between the people and the ruling class and the nation. And it was just beautiful to see. And it was the same, after Elizabeth died, I noticed the same things. And that's why even though I have criticisms about the royal family, as anyone does, I just realized that it's not the right time to make it about that. Because what you're seeing is something beautiful. Just another anecdote. I know it's inconsequential perhaps, and people might not have a very high opinion of him, but the fact that, David Beckham queued, he waited in the queue like a normal average Englishman on the day of the funeral. He was there with the common people to pay respects to, the departed mother of the country. It was special. It was nice. And we don't have it in this anodyne, globalized, monoculture, multiracial modern world.
Yeah, it is something meaningful. And the modern world excels at draining the meaning out of everything.
Mm-hmm.
That seems to be almost the point of it, to leave us completely derastic.
Everything from the buildings and the art and, what's being done in particular in Britain is very insidious. It's your countryside is racist. Your art is racist. All your national symbols are racist. Everything has to be decolonized, overturned, undone. And all the new buildings and all the new art is ugly, intentionally ugly to demoralize people. It's pretty much the same everywhere else. So I understand what's going on, but it must be very difficult to live in. I feel like I'm being a downer. This is millennial. We're supposed to be cheery and, you know, good, be of good cheer. I'm so sorry.
It's all right.
Well, no, what you're saying is true. Again, I guess.
What you're saying is true, but this is how this is why I can go on rants about architecture. Mm. You know, mm-hmm. because it's so true, yes. and it keeps being true. But yeah, I think that this is just something that's obviously it's not going to be sorted out overnight. I am going to be surrounded by ugly, shitty buildings for the rest of my life. I'm resigned to that. I know it's fine. I've to some extent, I've made peace with it. Let's see if that's not too ambitious. Yeah, I know it's a reality. But still, it is worth talking about because for a lot of people, it won't be quite apparent that this stuff does matter. I've even had it with older people, boomers. They don't understand the significance of buildings because it sounds like abstract. And what are you talking about? You know. I don't want to get into that. The point is, people seek meaning and meaningful connections. And meaningful so that they can have a relationship with a thing. I don't like that. I've forgotten who it was who said only connect. And I hate this concept that we're all connected and we've all just got to connect. It's like it's hippie. I hate that. I really hate
like Alan Watts or something.
Yeah, that kind of thing. Yeah. But at the same time, it is true that people do seek connection with things, and to be separated, to be deracinated from everything is a miserable existence.
One of the boogeyman buzzwords of our time is tribalism. Don't be tribalist. Just tribalism. Oh, the world needs less tribalism. It's like, well, tribes were the number one way of keeping your ass alive throughout all of human history. If you weren't in a tribe, you were vulnerable. You were not going to make it. And we dumb moderns that in our hubris think that tribalism is bad. Oh, don't be tribalist. What are we? That is something that you can say only because you live in such luxurious comfort. But the moment the Wi-Fi connection goes down and the moment there's no electricity and the moment the supermarkets aren't lined with ready-made meals, you're going to see a lot of people coming together or they won't survive.
That's absolutely true. But also remember that girl from with Constantine Kissin. You know, she knows that this stuff matters because a foreign group abused her and violated her. So for her, this is a reality already. She doesn't need to be in total poverty with a society falling apart. It's apparent to her that tribalism would have protected her. She said it. She said it herself. I think that this is the thing. People are very comfortable, but they're also still, even now, largely insulated from the effects of diversity. But white flight is becoming ever more difficult. It really is. I mean, it's not even in the last 5 years. It's a different thing to escape from this. So,
yeah, definitely.
I do think that more and more people are going to wake up because it would be incredible if they didn't. That's that. Let's wrap up now because I think this has been a really good conversation, and I think we should quit while we're ahead.
Sounds good.
Yeah, people have been saying nice things about it. There are a couple of super chats, so I'll get to those now. Green Party said, I enjoyed Angela's podcast interview with Keith Woods recently. Amazing how many good young people are on our side. Yeah, and Keith Woods
just to interrupt one moment, I didn't actually say where people could listen to this, did I?
No, but the links are in the description.
Okay.
Because I always think it's kind of ridiculous to have people spelling a URL or something when you can just have the links in the description. So don't worry. It's right underneath the video for anyone who's curious.
Rose is on the ball, as always.
Well, thank you. I do try to be. And then You Know Who said, great work, MW and AP. Thank you very much. Was there one on... Oh, yes, there was one on entropy as well. This is from Black Pigeon Pilled. I've often thought that growing up in the 21st century in the aftermath of the world wars of the 20th century is like waking up into a nightmare. Murdoch Murdoch's episode Metamorphosis illustrates this well. I can't remember that particular episode. I almost certainly did see it, but I can't remember it by name, so I'm sorry. My question for Angelo is how we best quell such feelings of alienation in environments that should be so familiar? That's an interesting question to end with.
Yeah. Feelings of alienation. It's really, really difficult. I was saying earlier, I always feel sort of more like an observer, an outsider, more than a participant, just because of my story and the way my life has turned out. But having that outsider's perspective actually means that I can appreciate a lot more, I think, things like community and solidarity and nationalism, a nation that you feel like you belong to, and pride and all that, because, you know, it's like living next to a beautiful cathedral. You know, imagine people who live in Rome. You know, they drive by the Colosseum on their daily commute, you know. At some point, the Colosseum just becomes another building, really. But it, to the outsiders, it's the bloody Colosseum. It's a marvel. It's amazing, you know. And so I still kind of have that fresh outsider's innocence and awe about these things, because it's like what you said, you know, you don't know the worth of something. You don't know what you have until it's gone. And so for me personally, going all the way back to the first days that I made YouTube videos, I kind of represent truly the rootless, I'm not so cosmopolitan, I suppose, but the rootless person, the global citizen that they want us to be so badly, and that some people delude themselves into being proud of being the global citizen. And I'm here to say, you don't know how bad that is, actually, to belong to nowhere and nothing and not feel that sense of connection to a people that you can call your own. And so to see places that did used to have that becoming sort of, you know, global homo slop, losing their character, losing their roots, their traditions, everything's sort of being Americanized in a way. Actually, the last thing I wrote for my Substack was how globalism is actually kind of more accurately Americanism. We're all listening to American music and watching American series, and then the buildings become uglier, and it is hard to see, because I can see something being taken slowly, or in some cases quite quickly, away from people. And I don't have an answer to, you know, how to react to that. I think you have to resist it. You have to resist it, and you have to understand the value of what they're taking from you and communicate that to people around you. And then I suppose in your personal life with your friends and family, you know, maintain the traditions. You know, don't listen, for example, we're at Christmas time, we're at Yuletide. Don't listen to the Christmas carols that were mostly written by American Jews and don't have much to do about Christmas at all. Listen to Christmas music in your native language. If you're not in the Anglosphere, you know, listen to Christmas songs from the 19th century, the 17th century, monks, you know. Rediscover your traditions, your roots, the things that make you and your people special, and you know, keep those embers burning, I suppose, is what comes to the top of my head right now. But it's something that I've experienced, that I've lived through, and it is difficult to feel alienated, especially if you're not a wanderer like me. It must feel doubly worse to feel alienated in a place where you actually belong. But now you feel alienated because it's become an alien terrain. I felt that when I went back to Italy recently, and I passed through Rome for a bit. It was my first time being back in Rome in a few years because my family's not from Rome. And it was like being in an alien terrain. I was just constantly asking myself, what happened? And who are these people? So yeah, it can really do a number on you.
I think it's more important than ever that we remember who we are, each of us individually, where we come from, our ancestors. I think it can be quite misguided to try to focus too much on that and to sort of try to fetishize it. It has to be something that's real and meaningful for you. Otherwise, you're it's fake. So I never tell people, you know, learn about the ancient handicrafts of your people, because that might mean nothing to them. It might just be boring for them. But there will be ways. There will be multiple ways in which you can that work for you, that help you to feel a connection to. Well, there is a connection. It's not an illusion. It's not something you have to manufacture. It is there. The question is making it nourish you, and there will be multiple ways of doing that. You just need to find them. You just find the ways that work for you particularly. That's what I would say to that. I obviously do my work that everyone knows about. I also am on Substack. I'm getting into sort of folklore thing, researching history, preserving history of my hometown. I haven't published any of that yet. But I will be next year. And that's a thing. Just to study the people that we are, the things that we've done, the cultures that we've created, the situations that we've created. That's my way. But other people will have other ways. And
it's not, it's okay to feel confused about this or not know quite what to do, because no one's ever really had to do this. You know, it's like the fish that doesn't ask what is water because it's surrounded by water. All it knows is water. Most people never really had to ask or feel alienated because there wasn't multiculturalism. There wasn't mass communications. There wasn't all this stuff that we're living through now. And it's not just affecting us. This is happening also in Japan and Korea. And I've even seen people in countries like India, Indian, you know, traditionalists, Indians bemoaning modernity in their country and the loss of their traditions. This is happening everywhere, really. It's even happening in the Arab Muslim world. We're all kind of being stripped down, and we're all being remodeled, remade in the image of these modern globalist technocratic gods. So it's okay to feel a bit confused and not know quite what to do or how to feel about it. It's something that is unique, I think, to us and our time.
Yeah. I would just say, don't worry about it too much. Don't stress about it. And, cause that will not help. Also to him particularly, I would say if your own area where you grew up, now feels alien, that's terrible. And I'm really sorry that that's happened to you. But I would say move somewhere else that doesn't feel alien. And I know it sounds like defeat, but it's not. It's just practical necessity.
I agree.
Because you can't change your area back. So yeah. I would say just move to the town next door or the town next door or the town next door until you find...
Sometimes you can actually run away from your problems. You can move away to somewhere better. It's okay to do that. It's not actually running away from your problems. No. It's okay to move somewhere where you're going to feel better. The problem is that those places are getting fewer and fewer in number, and it's not a long-term strategy. Obviously, if this continues, this alienization of our homelands and our nations, but it's okay. I do agree with that as one of many strategies to go somewhere else where you will feel better.
Yes. Okay. All right. Well, let's end it there. I think that's all the super chats. So, yeah. Okay. Excellent. Well, this has been a really good conversation, Angelo. So thank you very much.
Yeah. Thanks for having me on, and best wishes for the rest of Millennial.
Okay. Thank you. I'll be back tomorrow with Nina Power, Benjamin Boyce, Good Old Boys, and Hearthfire Radio. I never realized, see, until I say it out loud, I didn't realize that there was sort of unfortunate rhyme there with Benjamin Boyce and good old boys. It's the kind of thing that you wouldn't notice until you read it out. But nonetheless, I don't think anyone will be annoyed by that. So yeah, I'll be back tomorrow with another four interviews. In the meantime, that's the end of tonight's entertainment. Okay, Angelo, thank you for appearing on Millennial X.
Thank you.
Okay. I will be back tomorrow. I will see you all then. Good night.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. The festival goes on, but how about giving something back to your tireless host? Sometimes the old ways are the best. To send Millennial Woes some special Yuletide cheer by post, you can use the P.O. Box. Address on screen now. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him to keep the lights on.